You're listening to A Question of Balance on 2SER 107.3 FM. Good evening, I'm Ruby Vincent. Well, this year I've been discussing with a number of my colleagues who contribute frequently to A Question of Balance, and one of the things that we disagree on is what do we mean by life and evolution and what are the dominant creatures on Earth. And one thing we do agree on, however, is that humans are far from the dominant species. They act as if they are, as they munch and crunch their way across every landform they come across, often wiping out current life forms there. But are they the most numerous? Are they the most successful? Have they been around longest? And the answer is no to all of those. And we are tending to agree that in terms of numbers, obviously the most successful are microorganisms. And in terms of who's been around longest, it's obviously microorganisms. After all, they were the very, very first creatures, and we're going to hear more about them today. And how successful are they in terms of being able to deal with climate change? Well, the fact that some of these single-celled life forms have been around in a very, very similar form to several billion years ago suggests that they are probably close to the very first and the longest existing life form on Earth. Anyway, we've had a couple of shows on this, and we're going to again visit stromatolites, which are very interesting because they are the first evidence, fossilized evidence, of communities, if you like, that these single-celled organisms have managed to leave behind. It's not as if they were done through intelligent communication or writing books or any advanced form of communication, but certainly it's likely that organisms that for one reason or another managed to get together in a crowd have a better chance of surviving than ones that are out there in that rather dangerous environment and survive. So let's hear about stromatolites. And again, Australia is very interesting because we have some of the best fossilised evidence of these very, very early life form communities on Earth, and indeed of ongoing living forms of the descendants of these life forms. I guess it's another advantage of having away from the munching and crunching of large numbers of human beings and higher organisms for so long. Dr. Brendan Burns, who's from the University of New South Wales, discusses more about these life forms and their stromatolites, of which there are acres of them surviving today up in Shark Bay. I know that in Western Australia we have something that seems to be called modern stromatolites. Is Australia unusual in relation to stromatolites, or are they things that are sprinkled all over the place?
The best place to find these modern stromatolites, there's a couple of other locations in Bahamas actually, but Australia has probably the best example of these modern analogues, and there's ancient, or so Western Australia is actually a location for studying the evolution of early life.
Now, I think we should go back and you should give a slowdown on what are stromatolites. It's a great name. What's it about?
It is a great. I think it's from the Greek terminology. Basically, think of them as living rocks. So if you were to tap on them, it'd be like tapping on concrete, formed by billions of little microorganisms, bad bacteria or something that makes you sick. But there's actually a lot of good interacting, talking together, and they actually trap the sediment around them and also their own metabolism, if that's a good enough word to use. And they actually make these guys form. And they've been doing it. This is the kicker. They've been doing this for over 3.7 billion years. So they're one of our earliest known examples of life on Earth.
Can you tell us what they look like?
So they look like is like a large cauliflower. So this kind of column going up maybe about a meter or so. And they form on the intertidal area. So if you imagine being on a beach where the waves are coming up, these guys basically form there. And they're basically hard rock-like structures, and they form in a column. As I said, the best description I can give you is a kind of a cauliflower-like structure. They're very hard structures, but it's the activity of the little bacteria inside there, their own little functioning and grabbing sediment, sticking it together, other activity of their organisms that actually cause these structures to form. And why they do it is one way is to help protect them by getting things close together like that. Most of these actually form in what we call extreme environments, and it could be high temperature or a lot of salt in the ocean. And by forming these structures, it can help you protect against some of the harsh aspects of nature.
A Taste of Americana Festival lands in Sydney this October, featuring seven acts and over 7 hours of music. Hear a sensational array of the best local and international artists, including Margot Price, Kevin Welsh, Casey Chambers, Willie Watson, Joshua Headley, William Crichton, and Little Georgia. Don't miss a Taste of Americana Festival, Sunday, October 14 at the Enmore Theatre. Tickets on sale now at ticketek.com.au. Chug Entertainment sponsors 2SER.
Now, you've said things there that I think, for a lot of people, including me, minds are reeling. You are talking about grotty little single-celled creatures, if you can call them creatures, but just single cells, working together. I mean, that's the thing, working together to create these large, strong, lasting structures, as if they're a community. Right. Suggests some kind of communication.
There is, that's the best way to look at it. You can look at it as some kind of a social community, like an apartment complex with different layers and different levels. And people have, and you think about that with human society, I guess, any kind of society that actually functions well, and we have many examples of it not working well, works well by people working together and interacting. And this is exactly what these guys do. Very different bacteria, little microbes, little slimy guys are there. They interact with each other. They actually talk to each other, in a sense, by sending little signals, and that might tell one organism, little bacteria, to do something that will help the community as a whole. So it really is, you could almost look at it as a living, breathing, higher organism, but it's part made up of tiny, tiny, tiny little ones as a whole. So it's a fascinating ecosystem.
So when you say they're sending out signals to other little ones, I guess what you're really indicating is that they're kind of sending out general, I don't know, vibes, I'll call it that if you like, or pH changes or something. And if there are some of their suitable bacteria there, they might react in a certain way. So it's not actually directed at other microorganisms. It's just out there in the environment, but the ones that are their ilk or kind will respond in a useful, cooperative way.
That's one way, but actually it could be more in that it could be that very different organisms are, and we've got some evidence of this that suggests that perhaps organisms that are completely different out some kind of signal. It's hard to know because you can't really call an organism having some kind of a planned behavior towards another one, but by accident even, this other organism responds to that signal, it changes something that is beneficial to the community as a whole. So it's hard to know whether or not organisms are doing this completely deliberately, but maybe they've evolved in a way that it works, and it works for them so that they've survived and they've adapted by taking advantage of randoms that are being sent out, perhaps for other means, but then they can change their own way of life, for want of a better word, to help the community as a whole. So I think it could be a combination of the two, but it's really interesting.
And I suppose good old survival of the fittest would be absolutely in there, culling the ones that didn't have this cooperative, whatever we want to call it.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Now, something else you said there that staggered me, and that was, I thought these were things that, you know, sort of might be ankle high, but you're saying they can be a metre? How tall?
Well, tall, maybe about 2 metres tall, so you get to think about half of that. I mean, that's, some of them can be smaller, but you can get up to that. If you were to get any higher than that, then I suspect they would eventually kind of topple over. So there's probably a limit to how high they could eventually go. The other thing is they form very slowly. So these things take, you know, literally thousands, if not millions of years to actually form these massive structures. But they're slowly ticking away, and they've been doing this for a lot longer than we've been around. One thing that has been thrown out there is these used to be really dominant, if you, for want of a better word, on early Earth, but then they shrunk in their distribution, and that's why they're only found in a few places like in Western Australia and a couple of other locations. And one of the reasons why they thought they've shrunk down so much in terms of their overall distribution is because they're a very popular meal for some higher organisms to feed on, because they're rich in a lot of material, nutrients, things like that. So now they happen to form in, as I said before, these kinds of extreme environments, which the one in Shark Bay is, with high temperature and high salt. So it actually stops other organisms, or many other organisms, from growing. So that's why they tend to be able to form in areas such as that, that have been as a result of the changing environment around them.
We had one of your colleagues, Professor Riccardo Cavicchioli, talking about the domains of life, and I seem to recall bacteria don't have nuclei.
Yeah, they don't have organelles, which are small little components of each cell that we have in our body that do little functions, keep our body ticking over. So in bacteria, everything is just basically a soup. It's all thrown in together and doing its thing. So you just have a little cell with a what you call a membrane around it, and then everything is just shoved in there.
And our kinds of cells, which do have nuclei, a kind of a mongrel breed where a different kind of single-celled creature swallowed or engulfed something like a bacteria. And I think they're the mitochondria now. Is that right, or have I got that confused?
No, that's true. I think that's one of the theories that out there about how higher organism cells form, such as the mitochondria. Again, which you're saying is right. It might have been a bacterial cell that was engulfed, and then inside that became the mitochondria to do the respiration part of the body. It's also thought that the chloroplasts, which are the organelles in plants, which help with photosynthesis, where you're getting energy from light. Bacteria also do photosynthesis. They may have been engulfed by larger cells to eventually form a plant-like cell. So there's different theories about how higher cells may have been formed from potentially bacterial cells.
So bacteria were there before these so-called higher dog-eat-dog kinds of cells for plants and animals.
Yep, absolutely. So it's interesting when you think about where we are now, and most of the microbial life that is out there you can't see. But when you think about it, almost every little environment on Earth has some kind of microorganism or bacteria, and they've been happily doing their thing, as I said, for well over 3 billion years. And in fact, with the stromatolites, one of the main organisms that's in these formations is something called cyanobacteria or blue-green algae. I think people might – sometimes you get these algal blooms in summer, sometimes around Sydney, but these are also components of these systems. And one of the most important things that these guys do is produce oxygen through photosynthesis. And in fact, it's thought that the very first oxygen that was even produced on this planet was because of those organisms in these stromatolites. So this is a bit profound, but we could perhaps owe our very existence to these living rocks.
How come we have modern stromatolites over in somewhere like Western Australia? When we say modern, when did they start to appear there?
I think the ones in Shark Bay, when we say modern, we're probably looking at the thousands of years or even tens of thousands of years. But I guess when you say modern, they're living and they're doing their thing, for want of a better word, right now as we speak, as opposed to ancient or fossilized examples, which are just basically what you're getting records in the fossil record of ancient stromatolites. In the ancient stromatolites, you can get some information about how old they are, but you can get not as much information apart from that. But the great thing is with these modern ones, as I said, these are ones that are currently forming now and they're living quite happily. That's where we come in, because we use these as a window to our past. We treat them as natural living laboratories, because we can study these modern ones, who's there, what they're doing, and then we can use that as a way of extrapolating to potentially what might have been happening even on the early Earth.
I guess it's also a fabulous way to look at how these microorganisms somehow or other manage to cooperate. I was thinking in relation to other microbial functions, maybe in medicine or food production, all sorts of things.
Absolutely. I mean, most of what I do with these systems, you would classify as called blue sky research, which is kind of looking at something to advance the knowledge and understand more of what's going on. But the reality is there are potential applications you can get out of studying these things. They could then be applicable to medicine or industry. For example, we find a novel microorganism, and we often do, and they could potentially have some new novel pathway or protein or even a novel antibiotic in these systems that then we could potentially exploit for medicine, or even a novel function where they can break down oil or something like that. So just by studying these and understanding them more as well, we actually may find aspects of these that could be applicable to other aspects of our daily lives.
With the fossilised ones, there must have been other organisms around, particularly, you know, in the later parts of the tall ones. Do they have fossilised other little creatures in those stacks, sort of cemented into the debris?
Normally it's mainly the bacteria or the microorganisms themselves. I mean, sometimes I think maybe they've been able to find some examples of potentially higher organisms, but I'm talking more, they're still small, but more like these protozoa or slightly higher, slightly bigger than bacteria, but still nothing like, you know, plants or animals. And these are the ones that actually, sometimes they actually feed on bacteria. So sometimes I think they are found, but normally it's just the bacteria that we're finding in there.
Do they grow in clump? What's the sort of the paddock of stromatolites like?
They grow together. Actually, that's a good point. I don't know what the collective term for stromatolite is. We may have to make one up. But essentially, they form in a, maybe you could call it a field of stromatolites. And if I was wading through Shark Bay in Western Australia where they're found, I would see them in small little clumps, as I said, and probably about maybe half a meter apart or something, sometimes even closer together, almost touching. So, and in Shark Bay, they can sometimes stretch these kinds of fields for kilometers even. So they're really quite extensive in that particular area.
And you're saying that they tend to grow in response to some kind of negative environmental pressure. So that suggests that whole area must have had something either very salty or the water rising or the temperature too high. Is that correct?
That's right. So in Shark Bay, probably one of the main, I guess, negative on other organisms is the salt. So it's quite salty. And the reason is a while back in Shark Bay, there was a change in one of the embankments, I think, that this bay was made up of. And it meant that there wasn't as much seawater coming in, and that effectively allowed the salinity to increase dramatically in the particular area there. And so it meant two things. One, that these stromatolites had to evolve to adapt to this high salinity. And two, it meant that the higher organisms that normally hang out there and potentially feed on these systems couldn't survive in the high salt. Those kind of perfect storm events, if you want to be, allowed these guys to flourish, particularly in this area.
Has the water level in that area changed over time?
No, it has. And it's actually a good question in terms of what's very topical now, obviously, with climate change and the potentially increase in sea levels, in that these systems have been around, these formations, as I said, been around for billions of years. But in my opinion, they're still very susceptible to changes. And if, for example, there was an increase in the sea level that then increased in where these are found in Shark Bay, there's quite likely that they wouldn't be able to survive because they're not normally surviving in deep areas. So I think it's very important that we use these, if you want, as like an environmental dipstick. These are great for monitoring the health of our planet. If we see change, it's like the canary in the coal mine. If we see damages to these stromatolites, or if their health is deteriorating, or the microorganisms inside them, and that could be a result of increasing temperature or increasing sea level, then it suggests that we're going in the wrong direction. So these are, I think, very good way. Studying them, we can also study them from a conservation and also a kind of climate change point of view.
Hi, I'm Kerry Glasscock. I'm the Festival Director of the Sydney Fringe Festival, and we've reached our closing weekend. Tonight you can see Banda Lucia Flamenco. These guys knock your socks off every time. They've won Best Dance Performance at Sydney Fringe before, plus at a number of other festivals around the country. It is amazing music, incredible dancing, and they almost always have a fantastic international guest when they do their performances. So head on down. They receive 5-star reviews all over the place, and it is a guaranteed fantastic night out. Tomorrow, take the whole family to La La's Big Live Band meets the Sydney Youth Orchestra. It's a terrific show to close our Fringe Kids program. ABC Kids favourites are joining forces with the Sydney Youth Orchestra to meet all the instruments in the orchestra, and it's fun for the little ones, and they're performing at Sydney Town Hall, which is a bit special. If you want something a little more adult, you could head to Illicit Tonic tonight. The beginning, it's a sensual circus with death-defying acts, mesmerising magic and bombacious burlesque. What's not to like about that? I'm a huge fan of anything that the guys at Giant Dwarf send our way, and this sounds like it's a super fun closing weekend show, so do head there. There's also a million other things on, so head to sydneyfringe.com to check it all out.
2SER is a proud media partner of Sydney Fringe Festival 2017.
Do we have any idea of what the oldest living stromatolite beds are? Oh, there's a word for it, beds. The oldest living stromatolite beds are on Earth.
As I said, I think they're probably more in the kind of tens of thousands of years, which is still relatively old, I guess, if you think about that. As I said, they're constantly forming, and they're kind of, if you imagine them as a tree, and you can see by these kinds of rings on the tree, and that tells you about the tree growing. The same thing is with a stromatolite. It kind of grows in these layers, and it might be just less than a millimeter a year even, and it just goes slowly, slowly, slowly. So eventually you can actually date these to see how old they are and potentially even what might have been going on at the time.
Fascinating is a word I try to avoid, but I do find it fascinating. My mind just keeps going back to it. Do you think it's changed the ideas of many scientists, apart from people like you in the area, in terms of the evolution of life? And
yeah, I think so, because by finding these kinds of formations or beds for whatever in different areas, and also in general finding bacteria and other small microorganisms that survive in almost every environment on Earth. You could microorganisms 2 kilometers below the Earth's surface, or under ice in Antarctica, or in a nuclear reactor. It changes our concept of the boundaries of life. And so it makes us, broadens what we might think of where life might have evolved on Earth originally, and also potentially about the possibility of life outside of Earth and all the possible environments of where life might be outside of Earth. So I think by studying these in the situation where they are now and understanding the potentially extreme environments that life can survive in, it really does broaden our concept of both evolution of life on Earth and the potential for life elsewhere.
And possibly of life itself, you know, I mean, this kind of communication, for want of a better word, between these incredibly simple little cells must certainly change a few textbooks' notions about communication.
Yeah, I think so too. There's dogma that you get in science about how things must have started or how they must have evolved, but the more we're starting to understand these kinds of systems and how complex they are, and how, as I said, things such as communication or talking between organisms have evolved, it suggests that they're you know, more cooperative and more interactive, even almost more social than we would have thought. And the good thing is, and it's a great time to be in science, because technology is advancing so quickly that our ways of studying these systems or any kind of environment is getting a lot better. And we can, in a really directed way, get a lot of information from these systems that we couldn't have got perhaps even 10 years ago. So it's a great time to be a scientist.
Oh, indeed. And I think it's changed the notion of what is a fossil rather dramatically, hasn't it?
Yes, exactly. Because, you can utilize different methods now that can actually help understand whether something was potentially alive. And there's always the issue, and I'm not a massive expert in this, I'll admit, but when you're looking at something that's a fossil, is actually being able to say for sure that it was a fossil. And that sometimes you can get things that are formed just through natural, non-biological means, and you don't want to be calling something a fossil that isn't, for example. But at least the methods are now out there that can really, where you can confidently say A is a fossil and B isn't, so you can be a bit more confident about what you're calling, and that helps us understand a bit more about the potential evolution of life.
I imagine space exploration and NASA-style interests may possibly make funding into things like stromatolites and these early bacterial systems rather more lucrative than it could have been.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, it's I won't lie, funding is always a challenge, even in Australia and anywhere for that matter, because there's a lot of good science being done and it's very competitive. So a lot of the work we do and others in this area actually is born out of collaborations with NASA, because they're very interested in understanding the evolution of life on Earth, and these stromatolites are used as major markers of those. But as I said, even understanding that, I said these are forming in often very extreme environments, and if we think about potential for life elsewhere, a lot of people mention Mars. Mars has very similar conditions, or it was very similar to the early Earth. There's some very salty areas on Mars. And the reality is, if we were to find life elsewhere, it would probably be, at least in the first instance, some kind of a simple origin of something like a bacteria. And the idea is that potentially, if there is something simple like that, it would interact with its own environment, with the soil, and it could potentially form one of these stromatolite structures. So NASA are genuinely looking at these as potential, I guess, biomarkers for to potentially look for life elsewhere.
It does humble one, really. It seems so egocentric to think that life on other planets should be something to do with these grotty little creatures called humans, when the entire planet here is totally ruled and run and organised and largely shaped, I guess, in terms of the higher forms of creatures by these single-celled early domain of life creatures.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about, if we didn't have all these microbes around, life as we know it would definitely, in terms of us and other higher, would simply cease to exist.
Ah, that's exactly what Professor Cavicchioli said too.
You could imagine, so when we, you know, we get our energy or whatever by eating, so, and that's where we get things. Microorganisms have got all these strange little functions where they can utilize all these different forms of carbon and nitrogen and sulfur and all these other weird things that we can't do. So without their activity, then the kind of food chain of life wouldn't exist. And they can also, as I said, return gases to the atmosphere. They can also remove toxic waste. So a lot of the stuff that we take for granted about the way our atmosphere is, or the water or things like that, a lot of that is by the kind of balance that little bacteria actually bring about. So that's the whole idea of, you know, not all bacteria being bad.
Well, isn't it just as well they don't cooperate and communicate well enough to decide they're going to turn off the things that we need?
Very true. I think if they really knew what was going on around them, they probably would do that.
Okay. Well, there's a happy note on which to end. Look, Brendan, we've hardly touched the surface. Well, how could one? I mean, it's the story of life. I do hope we can speak again about more of this area. Thank you so very much.
No problem at all. It was a pleasure. I really love doing this, to be able to kind of try and transfer my passion for this to everybody else.
That was why I'm asking how you got into it in the first place. I always find it intriguing how people end up in funny little nooks and crannies, which I never even knew existed. That's Dr. Brendan Burns from the University of New South Wales. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ruby.
On the program today, you heard from Dr. Brendan Burns from the University of New South Wales. Today's story and sound files are on the AQUB website, www.aqob.com.au. I hope you'll join us again next week. Until then, please take care of the environment. Bye-bye.